Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager bringing you another installment of the Heretics Hour on this Monday, March 26th, I think it is, 2012. No storm tonight, so we shouldn't have any those difficult interruptions and droppings and so on that we had last night. But tonight marks the end of the second year of my bringing you this program. But I'm going to talk more about that later. I am broadcasting live from Voice of Reason during the next 2 hours. I'll have open phone lines during the second half of this first hour and the second half of the second hour. The number is 1-855-477-2283. At the top of the hour, in the second hour of tonight's show, my special guest will be on to tell us how or if we might attain freedom of association again under the current laws of the United States of America. Or is it just the United States? There's questions about that, and I find that pretty interesting. But I used to look into it, but I've kind of forgotten what I thought about it. Anyway, it's an interesting question. But I want to get on with my reading. I have to look at a message here. I don't see it. Sorry about that. I want to get off by reading from the fire because I have a little bit longer section tonight, which I want to finish before the break. So this week's reading begins at the bottom of page 141 and is about the American advance through the Sauerland in April 1945. Followed by Churchill's pathetic last-minute attempts to distance himself from the bombing campaign. Next week, I'm going to be reading the last pages of Chapter 2, which I've been reading for some time now, and which will conclude our study of the bombing strategy, which is the title of Chapter 2. All right, I begin. Whoops, I have to change my glasses. Until April of 1945, the area bombing war had touched those villages at most through stray bombs. But let me say that the Sauerland, to preface this with that, and they're talking about the southeastern corner of the encircled area. There was an encircled area now that the Germans' troops were in, and it wasn't completely encircled yet, but they were working on it. I mean, they were encircling the Germans in the Sauerland region. Now, that's S-A-U-E-R. The Sauerland region is south of the Ruhr, which we had been talking about, and it's a hilly and forested area. So it says, since April 1st, Hodges' First Army, that's the American Army, had been pressing into the enclosed region in the ski areas of Meschede, Brelon, and Winterberg, since this was the most probable escape corridor. You know, I learned finally how to pronounce what I was calling Xanten, X-A-N-T-E-N, which, of course, is Kazanten, Kazanten. That X is like a K-S, Kazanten. Well, I don't have that tonight, but it might come up at a later time. Hope I'll remember that. The closed-in units tried to make the contact with the army outside, but here, too, they were no longer the enemy. That is the closed-in units of the Germans. They were no longer the enemy they had been in December. The regular army had lost its bite throughout the encircled Ruhr area. Wherever it was confronted, it collapsed. The soldiers were burned out. They knew that no secret weapon or stratagem of Hitler's would be a way out for them. All that was left to defend was one's own life, and that was done best by turning oneself in. The First Army started climbing. I'm skipping a paragraph, but I don't think it's too important. The First Army started climbing the winding paths in the wooded heights of the Rothaer Range as soon as the cauldron was in place. Anti-tank grenades echoed up the entrances to the villages. In order to protect his men, Hodges had the sites fired upon for days by artillery and hedgehoppers before taking the town. Defenders avoided open countryside in order to maintain their cover, and the invaders did the same. They learned how to move in the forest and positioned their artillery there. If they were fired upon, they called for their fighter bombers to wipe out existing pockets of resistance and anything that would that could potentially become one, which usually meant the village itself. Most places had old mining tunnels, slate quarries, or stable beer and ice cellars. The farmers made them inhabitable, and during breaks in the bombing, they ran to check the if stables were burning, to feed the livestock, or to get coffee and food. As soon as the buildings caught fire, the owners tried to extinguish the flames. They would stand speechless, watching their possessions disappear if the hydrants had no water due to the lines being cut. Dead livestock lay around, as did fallen down masts. The sick and bedridden waited in the fields on stretchers to be brought back to rooms that no longer existed. Village after village became the hostages of martial combat commanders who confiscated houses and declared them to be strongholds. They decided it was time for the country folk praying on their rosaries to learn the facts of war, which consisted of, for instance, the 16 fighter bombers that disintegrated the village of Brocht with bombs and phosphorus in order to destroy the quarters of a company of the SS Panzer Division, Feldherrnhall. Oxygen in the slate quarries ran out. The people crawled into a tunnel up on Steimel Hill and in the Rodbusch. They heard the wretched whinnying of the 24 burning horses, the bellowing of the 15 chained dairy cows, and the squealing of the pigs down in the flame-engulfed town. The Americans set a fog bank and then stormed down from the Wahlberg Hill into the village hollow with hundreds of vehicles. On April 7th, after the fall of Fredeburg, Berghausen was the redoubt of the German front. The residents of Berghausen hid in the Niederberndorf mine tunnels. Only the pastor, along with 8 Franciscan nuns from Aachen, endured in the cellar of the parsonage because he did not want to leave to the flames his precious church with its Romanesque apse and the beautiful ceiling frescoes. The fighter bombers were above the village, and 15 bombs were enough to set it on fire. As the Americans marched in, the old and the new schools had been totally destroyed. The parsonage burned, and homes and farms razed to the ground. Those already lying underground were brought back to the surface when the cemetery was hit. Nothing escaped the fighter bombers' war on the villages, not Lechmart, not Schwart Mecca, and not Christa Laumann, the 7-year-old girl who had been evacuated from the hell of Dortmund and was found by a grenade in a room in Oberhennenborn. 10 Americans also lost their lives in Oberhennenborn because a vagabond German mortar battery fired a barrage. Nothing stopped the occupiers. It merely irritated them. The hour-long convoy of tanks, cannons, and troop carriers would not be retreating to the United States. On the evening of April 8th, the Americans, now we're in April 8th, 1945, folks, the Americans took control of the rubble that had once been Meschede, which is home of an abbey. I put a note here, but it talks about it a little bit later. The district seat at the confluence of the Ruhr and the Henne rivers. On February 19th, 1945, 20,000 incendiary sticks and 250 phosphorus canisters had burned down the town, which until 1220 was the first and only settlement in the Upper Sauerland region because a convent dedicated to St. Walburga had existed there for 400 years. The convent district, the small marketplace with its slated and half-timbered buildings, and all the buildings in the city center left this world. This was in Meshede. When around midday, light and dark columns of smoke hid the city from view for eternity, many people of Meshede cried, even though all but 45 residents survived. But like the Forsheimers, one-third of whom would be lost 4 days later, many believed this was the end of the world. The end of the world lasted 10 minutes, and then it returned on February 28th. Quote, somebody says, it was as if a terrible cyclone, a typhoon, rushed through, an air raid occupant later said, or a volcano had erupted and the end of the world was approaching. We had to reckon with a sudden, violent death and were kneeled in prayer. That's the end of that quote. A short time later, they counted 38 bodies before they congratulated themselves for surviving. A world had nevertheless come to an end, a world in which it had been inconceivable that pilots from America would come to use explosives to hurl a woman into the tree in front of her home on Brilloner Strasse, and that she would be dead when they brought her down. The story traveled from mouth to mouth about the demise of the family that burned to death screaming in the cellar of their buried house on Schützenstrasse, without anyone being able to come to their aid. Parallels to this were found in the martyrdom of St. Walburga and in the funeral service on March 5th. In the funeral service on March 5th, the Nazi Party claimed the incinerated victims as martyrs for its cause. Because the enemies could not win on the battlefronts, they said, the bomber terror raged. Well, that's true. They were telling the truth. And children and their children's children would pay them back for it. The people of Meshede all knew there was not a word of truth in that, because only 4 weeks later it turned out that the enemies had sent the bomber terror so they could win more easily. They pressed their way from the north and east simultaneously into the city. The fighter bombers had given into the city. The fighter bombers had given a real battering just a day earlier. The military had cautiously vanished to Remblinghausen, and all civilians born in 1900 or later were declared a Volkssturm militia. They shot apart a few tank crews, but this could not hold off the reconciliation of friend and foe. The Americans were satisfied that much remained intact during the demise of Meshede. Quote, they fried all the eggs I had in the cellar, reported an involuntary host, and they drank the wine I had been saving in the cellar for when my three sons returned from the war. Yeah, that's how it goes. They take whatever they want. It wasn't just the Germans who took what they needed in the East. They all do it everywhere, armies. An average of 127 people died each day in the aerial bombing war in 1944. Oh, this is good. Oh, this is amazing. 127 people each day in the aerial bombing war during 1944. That's how it averaged out. From January 1945 until the capitulation, which is only 4 months, the bombing killed 1,023 people daily, or a total of 130,000 people in the last 4 months. He writes, the last 4 months of the war represented the peak of the campaign. The British and American air forces dropped a total of 370,000 tons of bombs. Bomber Command sent its planes on a total of 72,880 sorties against the enemy. The raids included operations to support the ground campaign, oil and transportation raids, and reprisal actions. These distinctions made no real difference to those attacked. Someone from Hildesheim and someone from Würzburg could not say whether the bombs that hit them were part of a transportation raid or one to cause terror. The 21 residents of an old age home in Paderborn who were killed could not have prevented their deaths by complying with Eisenhower's conditions for closing up the Ruhr cauldron.
Churchill decided in late March to distance himself from the campaign. On March 28, 1945, he wrote to the Allied Chiefs of Staff, "It seems to me," and this is a quote, "it seems to me that the moment has come when the question of bombing of German cities simply for the sake of increasing the terror, though under other pretexts, should be reviewed." Then he proposed the priorities of 1941. Military objectives, such as hydrogenation and transportation facilities, which had been the objectives of the campaign all along. Churchill's denunciation of terror and wanton destruction, however, represented a rejection of himself. Churchill reinterpreted the strategic element of morale bombing into a characteristic of his confidant, Harris. We're talking about Bomber Harris. After the raid on Dresden, there was a general dissociation from Harris, whose horror-filled reputation lived on as a butcher and as a partner with sole liability. In the same way that the explanation for 5 years of polished strategy was reduced to Harris's disposition, I hope you get that, the purpose and the course of that strategy got lost in retrospect in the question of whether the attack on Dresden involved unjustified use of excessive force. Harris calmly noted that until late March, there had been Harris wasn't going to take this from Churchill, okay? Harris calmly noted that until late March, there had been a consensus on all decisions regarding bombing strategy. As his biographer has written, quote, up to this point, it was Churchill who had been the greatest protagonist of destroying Germany city by city, unquote. Harris had not been in a position to wage a private war. The strategy developed owing to his personal verve, imaginativeness, and leadership qualities. The strategy developed owing to these qualities of Bomber Harris. That is why he was put in command, and despite passing friction with Portal, maintained his position. There was constant discussion surrounding Harris's authorizations, the selection of urban targets, and the suitability of morale bombing in general and its ethical admissibility in particular. There is nothing more normal in war than that a method proves unsuitable, does not work well, and seems morally ambivalent, and that crass personalities have a chance to live up to it. The pros and cons of all that is normally reviewed alongside the offensive itself. Churchill viewed Harris as an odd character, but one that was beneficial to the cause. The bombs hit poorly what they should have hit better. It was a burden to annihilate innocents and a constant concern whether the bombs were helping the mission, and if not, what else could be done. This normal controversy merely flattened out the breach in civilization marked by the strategic air offensive. Its essence was beyond all discussion. All reasoning fell silent in view of what happened in its breadth and depth. So that is the end of the part I was going to read tonight. And I've got this part for next week, but I think I'm going to go ahead and start on that. Unless I have some remarks I'd like to make. I think that was all pretty clear and brought out here at the end that Churchill was trying to blame Harris and others for the bombing campaign once the war was just about over, and he realized what this was going to do to his reputation, and his lust to win, you know, had subsided some since they did win. They had won, and now he was left with looking at the judgment of history. So he did make quite an effort to blame Harris, but Harris really didn't allow him to do it. So although a lot of people still want to blame Harris for it, I was going to talk later about some things about Holocaust revisionism. And instead of waiting to say this then, I might say right now that someone who calls himself a revisionist made the comment on a forum that he's what I'm going to call revisionism light, and he said that some of us, he said, speaking of, he's British, speaking of the British, British revisionists, he's not as serious. He's kind of a revisionist. He says, some of us, you know, still consider Churchill a hero, who had what it took to, wage a war and carry us to victory against Nazi Germany, which had to be defeated, you know, and so on. And I thought, if this person still believes that, how can he possibly be a, what is called a Holocaust revisionist and still believe that? I don't know, but, I'm going to check a little message I've got here real quick. Oh, yuck. I'm getting messages I don't want. Okay. That don't fit, what I'm doing. All right. So since I still have quite a bit of time, I'm just going to go ahead and start with this next section. And it just follows from where I left off. 5 days after the start of the Russian January offensive, the second White Russian Front liberated Warsaw, which after 31 years again came under the control of Moscow. Marshal Konstantin Rokossovsky then divided his troops. The right arm moved up the Vistula River and reached Elbing at the southern end of the Vistula Lagoon on January 26th. That surrounded the Army Group North and caught East Prussia in a sack that was open to the Baltic Sea from the Sambian Peninsula to Elbing and extended southward to the lowland plains of the Masurian Lakes. I hope you realize that we're on the other side of Germany now, on the Russian front, on the Eastern Front, which is closing in very rapidly in Germany itself. The 1,850,000 Germans still living in East Prussia could escape via a land route across the frozen lagoon to the Spit toward Danzig. The Baltic Sea fleet had evacuated a large group of them, about 900,000, as well as 500,000 soldiers. In the last week of February, the Red Army spread out to the Pomeranian coast and occupied the section between the lower reaches of the Vistula and the Oder, roughly between Danzig and Stettin. Streams of people escaped by early March along the beach, many headed for Kohlberg Fortress, which German troops were defending. When the city was surrounded, there were 80,000 people inside who, during the next 10 days of siege, tried to catch a ferry to Swinemünde, the airy seaside resort on the island of Usedom. The port there was bursting with refugee ships and long railroad trains waited at the imperial bulwark to bring the East Prussian, West Prussian, and Pomeranian populations out of danger. People slept at night in schools and on train cars, hoping to be able to travel on to Denmark, Kiel in northern Germany, or even simply to the interior. Gertrude Thors sensed a thunderstorm in the air. She writes, "The Swinna, the river along which I lived for such a long time, on which I went ice skating and rowing, lay dark, threatening, and ominous before me." The images, this is January. We're talking about January and February, cold weather. The images of the overcrowded port, the refugees camping all around, the many trains with Swinemünde residents dutifully going around with coffee pots and bread, and with that, the constant fear of alarms made for an oppressive atmosphere. Well, that's the end of that. Among the waiting refugees were 900 survivors of the Wilhelm Gustloff, the evacuation steamer sunk by Russian torpedoes that had been brought ashore at Kohlberg, as well as the women who came with the long trains of people who had trekked along the beach, some of whom had asked cadets Wilfried, Wilfried Sander and his comrades from the Naval Artillery School to shoot them. That is, these women were hopeless is not the word. They were so demoralized by now. They just wanted to be shot. They couldn't. It goes on. They had been raped several times by Russians, and their children were lost. They were utterly demoralized and not responsive. Well, I should have just continued reading. So this was the condition of the people, the German people on the Eastern Front. Not only had these women been raped, but their children were gone. It says, from day to day, Swinemünde was getting filled with more and more women who had suffered this tragic fate. The cadets talked it over and felt it was hopeless from a military point of view, but they decided to fight to the end, if only to protect these pitiable women. Pauline Lundke, who had been evacuated from the Rhineland to Pomerania, was in the Kosoro Hospital, where she met young girls, 11 to 13 years old, who were not only seriously injured, but even before that had been raped by Russian soldiers as they were fleeing. They were children from East and West Prussia who had made a stop in Pomerania. Well, I'm going to stop there, ladies and gentlemen. We're time for our break. And when we return, I'll start in on something else, and you will be able to call in the next half hour to talk about this or what the new things I'm going to talk about. Stay with me.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Next, though, anti-war activists have held a day of action in key British cities to warn the authorities against a potential attack on Iran. A similar rally is expected in the capital of Israel, which is leading calls to strike over Tehran's nuclear program. Campaigners fear the mounting pressure could escalate into all-out war if it all goes very badly wrong, the effects of which would reverberate globally. Let's talk about this now with British MP Jeremy Corbyn. He's also a member of the Stop the War Coalition, which organised the UK protests. Jeremy, very good evening to you. Thanks for being on our It's appreciated. We've witnessed these protests today. We've seen other recent ones too in Britain and the US. The UK at the moment saying it wouldn't back an Israeli strike on Iran. The US has also signaled there is still room for diplomacy. So why are you so worried?
Because the rhetoric that's building up in the USA, because of the breakdown of diplomatic relations between Britain and Iran, and because of the deployment of naval forces from most Western countries in the Gulf at the present time, and the danger that comes from that, and the instant rebuttal of most Western governments of everything the International Atomic Energy Authority says. What we're keen to point out is that there is a serious danger of conflict with Iran. We need diplomacy, we need dialogue, but above all, we need an aspiration of peace and understanding in the region, not another war.
Well, of course, the whole background to this, Western powers saying Iran is concealing the development of a nuclear bomb, Israel insisting an attack on the country is the only way to foil such plans. Now, given the hostile relations between the two states, I guess there's a kind of an argument. I'm not saying it, this channel's not saying it, but some people argue that surely Israel has a right to take measures to protect itself.
Israel has 200 nuclear warheads, has a delivery system, has a research reactor, and certainly has the capability of bombing with nuclear weapons Iran or indeed any other country in the region. Israel is also not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran is and remains so. The last NPT review conference agreed on a nuclear weapons-free Middle East and determination to achieve that. That would mean some kind of debate or conference that involves Israel. I think the way forward has to be de-escalating the tension, denuclearizing the region. Otherwise, somebody somewhere is going to develop a nuclear weapon. I don't believe Iran has a nuclear weapon. I'm not even sure Iran wants to develop a nuclear weapon. But isolating Iran, allowing Israel to continue with these threats, and also allowing the assassinations to go on of nuclear scientists in Iran, when Iran has a legal right to develop civilian nuclear power, it seems to me a very, very dangerous development indeed.
I mean, echoing on what you're saying, there are intelligence agencies in the US and Israel are thought to agree that there is not enough proof right now to determine if Iran is building a nuclear bomb.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, listeners. I was going to say a little more about my two-year anniversary here at VOR. I have enjoyed doing this program, which I started on August 1st in 2010. Not August. I keep saying August. April. April 1st, 2010. That was my first program, and I've been doing one every week ever since. I've always had a new program every week, except when we have our little Christmas break that we have. But and as I said, I've enjoyed doing it, even though it is a lot of work. But I like to work, and I care about my message very much, particularly like the message I gave in the first half hour tonight. That was some pretty powerful stuff, which I'm glad I'm able to put across on the airwaves. And I'm happy if people receive my message. I would like more people to hear it. I think that the Heretics Hour is unique. I'm going to, you know, if I were a listener, just a listener, I would love the Heretics Hour. I'll say that. That's why I do it the way I do, because it's what I like. It's what I believe in. But I don't think even in the entire universe of alternative talk radio, there's another show like it. If there is one, I'm not trying to brag, really. If there is one, if you think there is, I wish you would write and tell me about it, because I would like to listen to it myself. So let me know what you think. Anyway, I wish, I'm giving here a happy 2-year anniversary, thought to the Heretics Hour, because, next week it will be the beginning of the 3rd year, and I will have a guest from, Germany, who I've wanted to have before. He's a young fellow who is very much he's very much on my wavelength, or I'm on his wavelength, but he has not been able to come on because of the time zones, you know, the time element. But he's going to be able to come on next week in the middle of the night. His family is going away, so he's going to be on his own, and he's going to stay up and or get up or whatever and come on the program. So that should be very interesting. I'm looking forward to it. But I also have a great guest coming up tonight, and he will be here at 9 o'clock. In the meantime, you can call in this half hour at 1-855-477-2283. Now, today I'm going to talk about some Holocaust issues here, whatever I can fit in the time that I have. Today, a story appeared in the news about Germany's national railway system, Deutsche Bahn, and the Holocaust. There's a lot to learn from it, so I'm going to go over it. And I'll just say right now that I was in Germany, I guess it's about 3 years ago now, and I traveled around on the Deutsche Bahn, and it is a wonderful railroad system. There's nothing that you could complain about it on, but you know, it's to portray it as it might, as some people might see, as these as this lawsuit is it's not against Deutsche Bahn, it's against the French railroad, but you know, if it should come to that, you know, it'd be portrayed as some kind of big corporation that, oh, they got plenty of money, they could hand out this money. Well, the Deutsche Bahn is not a big, bad, terrible corporation. They might have plenty of money, but they do a fantastic job for the people. And I won't spend any more time talking about what it's like to travel on their trains, but it's really you really appreciate that they will take you all over, everywhere, at all kinds of different times, and in comfortable conditions, and clean and nice conditions, and they're on time. You know, and you can depend on them. You can rely on them. So there would be no complaints about that company. Anyway, Deutsche Bahn is Germany's national railway, and it it came out today that they have hired 2 U.S. firms to lobby on Holocaust legislation in the United States, because there are 2 bills before Congress here in the United States, aimed at the French railway, SNCF, which I have the name of it down here somewhere. Doesn't matter too much, but it is those are the initials. And this is the French railway. And these bills before the U.S. Congress would allow the Holocaust Holocaust victims living in the United States. I assume they're all in the United States. I'm not sure, but to file lawsuits here in the U.S. because they're U.S. citizens. Now, continuing, this is all important part of the information. On December 13th, 2011, so that was this last December, Deutsche Bahn signed a three-month contract with the New York-based communications group Strategy 21 Partners to develop a communications plan related to Holocaust asset issues. And Strategy 21 Partners was to be paid $45,000 or 34,000 euros for this plan, to develop this plan for Deutsche Bahn. Now, Deutsche Bahn is doing this, of course, because these bills that I'm going to describe to you that are aimed at the French railway, they're concerned that they might then turn them on themselves, turn their attention on Deutsche Bahn and want to sue them also. So they're preparing. This is like the Boy Scout motto, be prepared. So they're trying to be prepared by thinking that what they have to pay here is not much compared to what they might have to pay if these U.S. laws get any feet on them. Now, then in December 19th, about a week later, Deutsche Bahn also engaged a New York-based law firm, White & Case, to take care of potential meetings with they're going to meet with members of U.S. Congress and U.S. government agencies on potential legislation regarding World War II related issues. Again, it's preparing just in case, and this might cost them up to $35,000. The law firm said, unless the scope of the engagement changes significantly, meaning that if Deutsche Bahn would actually become a litigant in some way and have to defend themselves, then it would go way up. But so this is $45,000 and $35,000 that Deutsche Bahn is spending here for two firms in the United States, this thing would go somewhere against them. Now, what this is related to is something called the Holocaust Rail Justice Act, which was introduced in the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives on March 17, 2011. That's 1 year ago. These bills were introduced, and the prominent support comes from Senator Charles Schumer of New York. He sponsored the Senate version. He's of course a Jew and probably the main Jew in the United States Senate. The co-sponsors are Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who is a Mormon, and I was checking on him. He got his start as chairman, his start in politics and so on, but he's from Nevada, as chairman of the Nevada Gaming Commission. Well, that's the casinos. And so he was put in place, or he was an asset of the Jewish casino owners from the beginning. And he serves the Jews. Everyone knows that. And not just Israel, but Jews. And he might as well be one. Now, the other Senate sponsor is the ex-vice presidential nominee, Joe Lieberman. Another Jew. You all know him. So the Jews are doing this to continue to extort money for these Holocaust survivors and keep this thing going. And now, continuing with this, the goal of the bill, is specifically targeted at France's National Railway, the SNCE, to enable Holocaust victims to bring, who they call themselves Holocaust victims, to bring claims against this French National Railway before U.S. courts for the French company's role in transporting Holocaust victims to concentration camps during the Nazi era. That's how they write it. You know, as soon as they, if by using the word Nazi, it's like anything goes, right? If it's the Nazis, well, you know, that was bad, that they were evil, and these people were victims of them, so they deserve almost anything that they ask for. According to the bill, the bill says that more than 75,000 Jews and thousands of other persons were deported from France to Nazi concentration camps on trains operated for profit by the Société Nationale des Chemins de Fer Français. That's the SNCF. You know, they claim this, and we know that most of the so-called facts and numbers of the Holocaust are false. But even, let's say, even if this was so, this is what they say. Previous lawsuits by Holocaust victims in the U.S. failed because American courts don't have jurisdiction over this railroad due to the Foreign Service Immunities Act. So, you know, they've tried this before. It didn't go. The courts wouldn't go along. U.S. courts wouldn't go along with it because there's something called the Foreign Sovereign. Did I say sovereign before? The Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And now this new bill, the Holocaust Rail Justice Act. Can you believe that name would strip the company of this protection? There would be no protection for it now. The woman, the New York lawyer who's representing these Holocaust survivors, and there are 600 of them, she says, her name is Harriet Taman, and she's a Jew. She attended Bryn Mawr College, or she graduated from Bryn Mawr College, and George Washington University Law School, and she speaks French. And you can see her in a very short 48-second video on YouTube. I can't give the thing on the air, but you might be able to find it by just giving her name looking it up. But I will put it on the program page, a link to it. But in this video, it's from 2004, and she's answering some questions about the suit, the failed one, I'm sure, because it's 2004, and that must have been when they were trying to do it previously. And she's speaking in French, except she uses a few English words. And you can tell absolutely how Jewish she is. I mean, extremely Jewish. So she is representing these 600 Holocaust survivors, she says. And they probably, the more would be allowed to receive money, compensation from this French railway, if the suit were to succeed, although I don't see how it can. But anyway, she told Deutsche Welle that the Holocaust Rail Justice Act would not apply to Deutsche Bahn. But Deutsche Bahn is not sure, so it's trying to prepare itself. Now, I want to just say, you know, this thing is so sickening. This is so sickening. These American Jews in Congress trying to do this and screw around with the law, and these people are our enemies. You know, they are our enemies inside the gates. They pretend to be Americans. They pretend to be of the white race. They pretend to be asking for justice for other Americans. But all it is for Jews. Everything about Jews outside of their own little enclaves is a pretense. They pretend to be something that they don't really believe they are and don't even want to be. Everything is a pretense. That's why I say more and more on this program, on the Heretics Hour, that we cannot tolerate them among us. Not even one. This is what they do, and they never stop doing it. Not even the so-called good ones, because can we tolerate? Because the good ones bring the bad ones, and the bad ones are in the vast majority. At least that's how I see it. So I would say contact your senators and representatives and tell them not to vote for this bill in any form. I don't know what the prognosis of it is, but they're saying it's looking good. It's gaining momentum. I read that. It's gaining momentum. I don't know, but, and maybe, you know, I shouldn't care about the French railway system or French railway, but I think it is so incredible that these Jews could push through something, through Congress that allows, Americans, to sue a European company, in the United States courts. Just doesn't really, there's something wrong with that. And maybe, the lawyer that's coming on in the second half, can tell us something about that. It's not really what he's come to talk about, but it would be interesting. So, that's my idea. That's what I have to say about that. I consider that just pure extortion. I'm sure many of you do also. Well, I was going to, I have quite a few little things to talk about, but I'll get this one done first. And if I have any time left, I'll go on to the other. And this is, what I was talking about earlier about revisionism light. Revisionism is something that not that many people, when it's Holocaust revisionism, not that many people are, really well, informed about. There are more and more people who understand the scam that it is, but they don't have all the facts, and it can be really complicated. So there are there's a whole lot of views about it, and I brought that up because I was going to say that at one time I knew I was I knew I didn't believe in the Holocaust as it is presented. But I wasn't sure, and then when I was sure about the gas chambers and the 6 million, then I wasn't sure about all the details. And you know, I just felt that I was always looking, reading, and studying to learn from the so-called experts, you would say, so I could understand it better. And now I feel that I wouldn't say I was an expert on everything for sure, but I feel like I understand it better than the vast majority, and I can speak about certain things with some conviction. And what I call what I'm having a problem with now is what I call Holocaust light, in which seems to be infiltrated to some degree with Jews, just as this whole story that I talked about earlier about the Congress. You know, it's Jews who are get into all of this, and they start taking over. And on a forum, there seems to be these they're either Jews and doing it because they're Jews, or they're British, and they want to they don't want Britain to take the blame that it deserves for promoting this all these years and for what it did during the war. So they don't want to rehabilitate Adolf Hitler in the slightest. You know, that's the thing. They want to deny some of the facts of the Holocaust. They'll even use that word. I mean, they know that it's not true, but they don't want to go all the way with it. And this bothers me because there seems to be, I notice this quite a bit, more than I ever used to. So they will say that they think that what's important about Holocaust revisionism is that there was not there were no gas chambers and there was no 6 million killed. It was maybe way much less than that, maybe at the most a million or less than a million, maybe 700,000 or even less than that, but then they will emphasize the terrible suffering of the Jews. They will always emphasize that and say, but we cannot deny that the Jews suffered horribly. Now here's a fellow who's saying, he says, as far as I'm concerned, revisionism is a wide and broad church of belief. I accept. So everybody, you know, can have from one end to the other, you know, fit in there. I accept that some have stronger, perhaps more extreme views about the Holocaust than I do. My feeling is straightforward and no gas chambers, no 6 million dead. But he says Jews were persecuted and suffered hugely with many tens of thousands dying during the war in and out of the camps. And this is supposed to keep the Jews from being blamed for what they've done all these years to the Germans and all the money they've extorted and so on, because they suffered, you know. And yet, how much did the Jews really suffer? I find a lot of fault with that. I don't think while a lot of Jews did, I don't think that Jews particularly suffered any worse than other populations did. So, and I don't think that they were blameless either. They were not blameless. They participated in some of it, and then they brought a lot of it on themselves, and then they also participated in undercover and in resistance movements which caused them to be sent to concentration camps and so on. If they had not done that, that wouldn't have happened. So there's a lot to be said here about so many of these views that people have. Now, they will say, well, if we just get rid of the gas chamber thing, and if we just get rid of the 6 million, then that's good enough. Well, as I've said before, that's not good enough. And then this guy also says, he's talking about the Reinhardt camps, the Treblinka, Chelmno, Belzec, so on, and he's calling them death camps. And so somebody calls him up on it and says, prove to me that they're death camps. How many people died there? Where are the bodies? Where are the graves? Where is this? Where is that? And he defends himself by saying, I use the death camps description because that is how they are generally referred to. Call them what you like, but they are called death camps by those with whom we have the biggest beef. You know, he includes himself, we. He says, we, those, the, he includes himself as a revisionist and says, the death camps, they're called death camps by those with whom we have the biggest beef. So I just call them that too, so that, you know, we know what we're talking about. Well, that really bothers me. Plus, you know, this kind of thing shouldn't be accepted. It just should not be accepted. And when these people are called up on what they're doing, they're the ones who get in trouble, not the ones who are doing it. That is on this forum. So that's also not right. But for him to use the phrase "the biggest beef" as though the disagreement that revisionists have with believers and exterminationists is just a beef. You know, there's something wrong here with this kind of attitude. And this person actually did say at one point that revisionism is just a fun hobby for him. Well, I wonder why he's even doing it, and I'm suspicious of people like this. So the other thing I was going to bring up is the numbers that there's a question about too many revisionists accepting too high in numbers in order to get along with those they're having a disagreement with in their writings. And this goes along with being too willing to accept that the Jews suffered, they had high death numbers, and that this all has to be taken into account when you work with revisionism. I see revisionism as revisionism light and maybe regular revisionism, and then revisionism hardcore, if you could call it that. And I would be in the hardcore section. And I think it needs to be. We need to be very, somebody used the word nitpicking, like, oh, why nitpick about this and that detail? Well, it's all in the details. It's all about the details. And if we don't get it clear, if we don't if we're not hardcore and if we're not tough about it, we'll never be finished with these lawsuits and this extortion for money, and we'll never be free of Jews in our societies either, because this is partly what they base their untouchability on. And even if you get rid of part of the Holocaust and you leave part of it, of Holocaust lore, I would say, it's not going to be good enough. So that's my rant for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. And when we get back, we will switch over to the topic of law and freedom of association and talk with our legal friend.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. The wife of the U.S. soldier accused of killing 17 innocent Afghans in a shooting spree in Kandahar 2 weeks ago says she cannot believe that her husband, Staff Sergeant Robert Bales, would ever commit the crimes of which he's accused. Carolyn Bales says her husband is a very courageous man who joined the army to help protect the United States in the aftermath of the Al-Qaeda attacks on New York and Washington on September the 11th, 2001. She says she's spoken to her husband twice by telephone since his arrest, and she told America's NBC television network about how the army first told her of her husband's alleged crimes.
Remember, they held my hand and they just said that perhaps, you know, they thought that he had left the base and gone out and perhaps killed the Afghan civilians.
Meanwhile, two British soldiers were killed at an international military base in southern Afghanistan by a gunman wearing an Afghan army uniform. From FSN's London Bureau, Sandra Gutman reports.
According to Defense Secretary Philip Hammond, a member of the Afghan army opened fire at the entrance gate to the British headquarters in Lashkar Gah City, killing two British service personnel. The shooter was then killed by return fire. 15 NATO service members have been killed by Afghan security officials or militants disguised in their uniforms so far this year. NATO forces have been working with the Afghan military to hand over control of security operations. Sandra Gottman, London.
The U.S. Supreme Court has begun a hearing into the legality of one of President Obama's landmark legislative achievements, health care reform. From FSN's Washington Bureau, Daniel Wrenches reports.
At the heart of this case is the question about whether the federal government has the power to require that individuals take out health insurance. The administration says Congress, by passing the Affordable Care Act, does. It also asserts that insured people currently pay about $1,000 a year in additional premiums to cover emergency care required by those 30 million uninsured Americans. Those opposing Obamacare, as it's commonly known, say that the individual mandate compels people to buy a commercial product, a power that the central government does not have, and that other provisions trample on states' powers.
The Pope is in Cuba. He flew into Havana at the start of a 3-day visit and was met by Raul Castro, now running the country in place of his brother Fidel. Speaking in Mexico before he landed in Cuba, Pope Benedict described the island's communist political system as outdated. Follow us on Twitter at Feature Story. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Contracts to purchase.
return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the second hour of tonight's Heretics Hour program. I want to apologize first off to those who called in the last half hour. Mike didn't know that that I was taking calls that half hour, even though I said so, but he didn't hear it. So I apologize to those of you who called in and didn't have your call taken. We will take calls in the not in this half hour, but in the last half hour to talk with Don. And my guest right now is named Don, and he has agreed to come on and talk about the general issue of, I hope this is right, freedom of association and what slavery and civil rights law have in common, and whatever else he can tell us. So welcome, Don. Did I say that right?
Yeah, you said it very well, actually. The question I'd like to put forth to all your listeners and to any thoughtful person who addresses the issue of white subjugation under the new racial caste system is, what do civil rights laws and slavery have in common?
Okay, and before you start that, let me just remind you and remind others that this came up a couple weeks ago on this program, where we when I had Tan Staffel on, and we wanted to talk a little bit about freedom of association, but we didn't start soon enough, so we didn't have much time. But we did agree that freedom of association is the key to our forming white communities again, and so this is why I'm really glad that that Don agreed to come on, and he has had some ideas about this for some time. So go ahead, Don, once again.
Yeah, freedom of association is indeed the key to white survival, separate and apart from the issue of regaining first-class citizenship for white people once again. And you look at the onslaught against white people in this Trayvon Martin case, which is an absolute outrage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was an incident in 2006 where a white 17-year-old was shot by a 53-year-old black homeowner in New York. It was kind of a reverse situation in Sharpton, and all these people came out on the side of the black shooter. And the black shooter was released from prison after serving 5 months of a 5-year manslaughter sentence by the black governor of New York, David Patterson. So that shows you how, and now they put a $10,000 bounty on the head of this guy Zimmerman, and regardless of what you think of him, it's a bounty dead or alive. And this is basically
who put this bounty?
The Black Panthers. Put this on. I mean, this is astonishing. I mean, this is soliciting murder and kidnapping. These are in themselves serious felonies, yet there's not going to be a finger laid on these people. And this shows you how far whites have sunk. They can actually put a price on our heads, and nobody raises a peep, or not much more than a peep. In any event, I'm a lawyer in California. I practiced here for some years. I'm not a big-time civil rights lawyer or anything like that. I basically do real estate and business-type work. But I became interested in the issue of white subjugation some years ago as a great fan of David Irving, and I met him at a book show and heard him speak a couple of times and kind of got immersed into the whole issue. And it struck me that the right of freedom of association was pretty important, and I did some legal research on it. Well, there was case law on it. Now, the Bill of Rights of the Federal Constitution says nothing about freedom of association, although it does. The First Amendment does say the right of freedom of assembly. And when you read the federal cases on it, they say freedom of association is an implied right under the Constitution. It's not an express right, but it is simply implied by the other rights, because if you think about it, virtually all of the First Amendment's rights, religion, press, speech, assembly, and petition for redress of grievances are associational rights. We don't need First Amendment free speech and free press protection to talk to ourselves or to read our own books. We need them in order to speak to other people and to present books and other written material to other people. So you've got an association issue there. And so I thought, aha, what we really need here is a constitutional amendment to make the right of freedom of association an express right. And in the course of doing the legal research, I found a number of cases where anti-discrimination laws were challenged by white people on the grounds that they violated the right of freedom of association. The court said, well, it's not an absolute right. It's not even an express right. Moreover, and this is a very important thing, the court said that for a white person to refuse to have a contact with a black person, quote unquote, was a badge of slavery. Now, you stop and think about that. A badge of slavery. And something struck me that this is very Orwellian, and it's really completely backwards. I mean, what is the essence of slavery? And you just look up slavery in the dictionary sometimes. You get a number of different definitions. There's one definition that says it's the ownership of one person by another. There's another definition that says it is the divestment of personal rights. But the most fundamental definition of slavery is a violation of the right of freedom of association by the slave owner over the person of the slave. Slavery is the right of a legally superior person to force a legally subordinate, unwilling person into an involuntary association called slavery.
Okay.
Okay. So what does that have in common with anti-discrimination laws, with so-called civil rights laws? Both violate the right of freedom of association. In principle, they are mirror images of each other. They are two sides of the same coin. So when they talk about a badge of slavery to give minorities the legally superior position in society that they can walk into a white person and force an unwilling white person to sell to them, to rent to them, to perform services for them, the effect of this is for the legally empowered minority to exercise the right to nullify the freedom of association rights of the legally subordinate white person. The effect of these laws, even though they are racially neutral on their face, but the way they are enforced, they are overwhelmingly enforced exclusively against white people. You don't see lawsuits by white people who want to get into black neighborhoods, who want to get into black schools, and who want to go to black churches.
No, that's the problem. You know, we don't want to go into any of these other groups. So they have a right to do whatever they want on their own. They don't have us bothering them, but they don't want to let us do it. Although I think they've been instigated back when by the Jews to do that, because they didn't used to think that they should be able to join white groups or go to white schools.
That is somewhat complicated. There was always a kind of a civil rights movement there. But if you look at this in the thread of history, the history of the 19th century was the overthrow, the Civil War, and the overthrow of a racial caste system, an explicit, open racial caste system in which blacks were on the bottom. History of the 20th century is the so-called civil rights movement, which was to establish a new kind of tacit racial caste systems with whites on the bottom, even though it's not explicitly called a caste system and it's not explicitly called slavery.
Can you name what some of the things are that have brought this about? Would you include, I never can remember what that's called, when you have to hire a certain amount of...
Affirmative action?
Yeah, affirmative action. Is that a part of...
Affirmative action is a violation of the right of a free association, and it's the violation of the right of contract. Historically, one of the essential elements to the right of contract was the element of mutual assent between contracting parties. And if assent was procured by force or fraud or deception or undue influence, then that contract was voidable at the option of the aggrieved person, the person who was the victim of fraud or force or deception or undue influence. So it's not only nullified for white people, the right of freedom of association, but the traditional right of freedom of contract as well. Interestingly enough, another thing slavery and civil rights laws have in common, and this really blows people away when you tell them this, they are both forms of forced racial integration. The first forced racial immigration was the slave trade and the abduction of Africans who were transported to various parts of the world to be slaves, of course, by Arabs and Europeans. And we all know that story far too well to have it repeated. But in the most basic sense, slavery was an abrogation of the right of black people to say, no, I don't want to associate with white slave owners and I don't want to pick cotton for free for white plantation owners. So now you've turned it upside down, whereby, you know, homosexuals can walk into a, a portrait photographer studio and say, you will photograph my gay wedding. And if the guy says no, he gets hit with a $100,000 fine. It's not just racial minorities. It's all these various goofball transgender, you know, the gender and sex and sexual preference and creed and national origin and the disabled. You know, the physical appearance. Now they want laws in favor of ugly people because they say, you know, beautiful people get more jobs as you know, movie stars and newscasters, and there should be, you know, the ugly people should have equal rights. I mean, there's no end to this nonsense. You know, there's really no end to it. So I formulated a kind of an idea for an amendment, a constitutional amendment. It said, in essence, the right of freedom of association is absolute and shall not be regulated or infringed by the federal government or any of the states or any political subdivision thereof. And the problem with that, it's a bit overbroad, because if it's that absolute and that overbroad, I mean, you could actually do away with the ability of the government to ban child labor, to ban associations between adults and children that might involve child molestation or something. So, you know, I've gone through a whole drafting thing here, and I'm working with a couple of lawyers, and basically we've gotten it down to the point where the right of freedom of association is absolute and cannot be regulated as long as it is exercised on the basis of race, creed, religion, disability, sexual preference, you know, blah, blah, blah. You almost have to get a laundry list of things, which is somewhat unconstitutional.
Yeah, but you know, in the environment that we have, that would never go. I mean, you'll never get anything like that to be considered.
Well, yeah,
right?
constitutional amendments have not been very successful, not at the federal level. I mean, in the 50s, you had the Brooker Amendment, which would have limited the ability of the Congress to undermine the Bill of Rights through treaties. Then you had the Liberty Amendment, which was kind of a conservative initiative back in the 50s and 60s to limit government a little bit. Of course, the proposed Equal Rights Amendment was probably the most recent and the most notorious of it all, and Phyllis Schlafly pretty much single-handedly stopped that. Obviously, the opposition to anything that would restore first-class citizenship to white people would meet with a firestorm of opposition. I thought initially just making it a talking point would be very useful in order to rally white people, because what could be more natural and more respectable and give people more confidence and say, we want equal rights for white people. We want to have our own associations, our own neighborhoods, our own communities. We want to have a national association for, you know, to protect white people. You know, we don't want to put a price on the heads of black criminals. We don't want that right. But we want many of the same rights of freedom of association that they have, the same rights of racial advocacy that they have.
Let's say that we just form something. We form associations or we form a community and we say whites only. Now, how would we use the law that there is to defend ourselves from the attacks that would come down on us, saying that we have no right to do this?
The problem is, if it involves housing, you're screwed. Okay, if it involves a business, you're screwed. You know, the blacks can have their own newspapers. I read Barack Obama's autobiography. He talks about how he was hired as a black person to work in the black community as a community organizer. I mean, this is a per se violation of the 64 Civil Rights Act. They can openly proclaim their contempt for the same laws that they're used to destroy us and destroy our freedom, and nobody bats an eye. So the answer is, if it involves housing, if it involves any kind of business, you're screwed, because they're going to be beating down the doors with civil rights lawsuits. I used to think it would be an interesting idea to go find some rural county in one of the Great Plains states that has essentially been deserted and take over the county and bring in a couple of thousand white people and take it over. But, you know, they parachute in a Department of Justice SWAT team.
Well,
put the kibosh on that.
Yeah. How about religion? I mean, I can't see why. If you stated that your religion had such and such beliefs, and then you form a community and you have a church and you have some, you know, whatever, and it's based on whites only, your religion.
That
why do you think that religion won't work for that? Because we have that.
Well, it's not working so well for the Catholic Church right now with their opposition to certain things. I think they would attack it. There was a small white church that came out against interracial marriage, and they came out, some little tiny nobody church that had 50 people, I think in Illinois or someplace like that. And the firestorm was amazing. They were going to take away their tax-exempt foundation. People finally had to come in and crawl and grovel. You know, what you're going to have to do is summon white people to find their courage and find their voice and fight this thing head on. That's what you're going to have to do.
I agree with that. But I
thought in terms of a constitutional amendment, and it might be worth doing if for no other reason than it would be a standard around which you could rally white people. White people need a narrative that they can use. And I like the narrative equal rights for whites. I mean, we have the Fifth Amendment, due process. We have the 14th Amendment, equal protection of the law. That is the context in which we operate. That is the reality in which we live. And we simply want to make the case, advocate the position that we want the same rights that non-whites have and the gays have and the transgendered and the disabled and the, you know, all these various and the Muslims and all these other groups who flock across the border and then proclaim themselves to be historically oppressed minorities.
I know you do, and a lot of people will agree with you about equal rights for whites. I've talked about that right here on VOR with on other show, on somebody else's show, who would like that, I think. But I don't like the word equal for whites, because I hate to ask for equal rights when we should have, you know, we're not just asking, we shouldn't have to ask for equality in our own country. I still think this is our country, even though I realize what's going on. But so I was telling you, I like rights for whites, but you didn't think, I don't know if you think that works.
It begs the question, what kind of rights do you want? They're going to start screaming about racism and white supremacy. You know, I don't want superior rights over these people. I don't want to lord over them. I just want to get the hell away from them.
Well, you know,
can
we ignore what they're screaming and yelling about if we have a legal, sound legal basis for what we're saying? I mean, this is they're always going to be yelling and screaming.
We don't have a sound legal basis because the political mood and the jurisprudence is that white people are second-class citizens and they need to be punished for the sins of slave owners who died before any of us were born. See, white people are accountable for the things done by slave owners 300 years ago, but minorities are never accountable for anything. That's another way that liability and rights are asymmetrically distributed and enforced in this country today. So you don't have the law on your side. You really don't. This is going to take a head-on fight. If we're going to survive, this is a war for extermination. It's not just relegating us to second-class citizenship. As though we were herds of cattle or flocks of sheep from whom they extract money to fund all of their various programs. I mean, they want us exterminated. I don't know who they think they're gonna steal from when we're gone. But, you know, maybe they don't think that far ahead. I've never figured out the minority mindset. You know,
They don't think ahead. They just go with whatever works.
This is a little off topic, but I've been listening to this Trayvon Martin nonsense all week, and I'm old enough to remember the 60s. I'm old enough to remember the 50s. I was very young at the time when they sent in the Army to protect Negroes so they could integrate white schools. There was never a question of anybody putting a price on the head of blacks. But, my God, where are the troops to protect white children who are the victims every day in integrated schools of racially motivated violence? They're nowhere. Okay. We have got to fight and fight it head on. And part of that is giving white people a narrative they can use.
Well,
whites are the worst advocates in the world of their own interests.
Well, here's
the
what I think.
Worst.
I agree. And I think it's because we don't have any clear idea what's happening. And we don't, you know, a lot of people still don't even understand what's happened, that you're making it very clear. But I still say that religion, you know, the Constitution, guarantees freedom of religion and how you exercise your religion. And there's lots of stuff what religion is and what religious beliefs are and how they are only the strong beliefs that a person has. Here's one from the American Heritage Dictionary: a set of beliefs, values, and practices based on the teachings of a spiritual leader. Well, you know, there's nothing. What would I say? Racial separation and racial reality is like a religion to me.
You know, that's my strongest beliefs on race and that my
You're not going to win with that in the courts. You're not going to win with that in the courts. There's no technicality that you're going to go into court and win with. We don't control the courts. The political power is on the other side.
All right, but even if you're not going to win in the courts, you still have a good legal case. And you were talking about in getting the people, you know, worked up and behind
No, you don't have a good legal case. The legal authority is against you.
Well, but I say by legal, I mean, well, you have a constitutional case then.
You have a constitutional case, but that doesn't mean anything if you don't have the political power to back it up.
Well, then the courts don't mean anything, is what we always come down to, because it's
all
politics.
Well, it's not that they don't mean anything. Sometimes you can file a symbolic case, and then you get publicity. White people have got to wake up. You know, you've got to get organized. It's going to take a large body of white people. And this is a little off topic, but I'll tell you something. I've watched this Trayvon Martin stuff and all this drum beating and, you know, we're going to put a price on somebody's head and no justice, no peace. This isn't going to work today like it did in the 60s. In the 60s, they were burning down cities every summer and white people got out their checks and started writing checks to pay them to stop. And ultimately they did. That is not going to happen this time. A, the money's not there. B, white people are sick of this crap. 50 straight years of this crap. And we've had enough. We've had enough. You cannot believe the things white people tell me behind closed doors. I mean nominally liberal white people. Mm-hmm. Read the comments on the internet news sections where they talk about this stuff. Mm-hmm. There's a simmering undercurrent of fury and rage in white people. And I think we're headed toward a turning point. I think they're going to overplay their hand this time, and I think there's going to be a white reaction against Obama. If he wants to jump on and ride this train, it's not going to be good for him. It's not going to be good for him this time. There is a change in the attitude of white people. White people are looking for leaders. They're looking for intellectual ammunition. They're looking for a good argument. They're looking for a rhetorical template that they can use to speak on their own behalf. And when you say slavery and the civil rights system are two sides of the same coin, they are based on the same moral corrupt premises, that's something people can jump on.
Okay.
I mean, I've run this by people in person, and I run it by some people on the internet, and they hem and haw, and they say, well, yeah, you know, you're literally right. Okay, slavery, you know, and chains isn't the same thing as being forced to take photographs at some homosexual's wedding or rent to a black if you don't want to, but it's the same basic premise. It's a violation of freedom of association and freedom of contract. And you've got to have some intellectual foundation, some fundamental from which you can use as a fulcrum to go forward.
Well,
you know, they're always talking about the black community. They can have their community. They can. Here in Los Angeles, we have a black newspaper called the Sentinel. All black writers, all black photographers. Try to start a white newspaper and see what happens. You'd be run out of town. You'd be lynched. We just want the same rights for us. And that is a hard argument to beat. That is a hard argument to beat. You'll get white people who will support that because it's morally right, and they can assert that without being credibly called racist.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I can't deny that, equal rights for whites. You know, personally, I don't like to be asking for only equality, but then since equality is better than what we've got.
What else are you going to ask for? What other arguments
you can
make?
I don't even want to ask. I don't think we should have to ask, but obviously, because I think it's like you say, white people have to just decide that they're not going to put up with this anymore. But they have to have some sense that they are connected by race. And they have to have some racial idea.
Okay. You want to know something interesting about this? The blacks had to fight the whites to get their freedom. You know who the whites have to fight to get white freedom, white emancipation? We have to fight our own kind.
Yeah,
these Mexicans and these blacks had Africa for 10,000 years. They couldn't figure out how to invent the wheel. And then one day white people showed up 500 years ago. White people figured out how to invent sailing ships and navigation skills. You know, 500 years later, blacks have learned how to use the wheel, but we figured out how to invent spaceships and go to the moon. Mexicans had their own country for 500 years, and they come across the border of this country here in L.A. They can't figure out how to use indoor plumbing half the time. These people are no match for us. They're not the enemy. We don't have to fight them.
That.
We have to fight our own stupid cowardice, our own stupid timidity. We hold the key to the locks on our chains in our own hands.
Well, I'm going to argue when we come back from the break that it's the Jew it's not the white people. It's the Jew who has taken over so many things and convinced so many white people of all these beliefs. And that's why I keep going back to him. And there is something, I've got something here about that, which I'll look for when we go, when we take
white
our
courage
break.
Is the key.
Yeah, it is. It is. But you have to know who the real enemy is, too, because the real enemy is really not, like you said, the blacks and the Hispanics. You know why? Because they couldn't even do anything, you know? So they're just, they've been instructed in all this by Jews. So, okay, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back in a few minutes and continue this program.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
North Korea may not officially be on the agenda of the nuclear summit in Seoul, but it's something that's hard for leaders to avoid, especially after Barack Obama's earlier warning to punish Pyongyang for what he described as bad behavior over its planned satellite launch. Irina Galushka is in the South Korean capital for RT. Irina, I guess it seems like President Obama chose his timing for his harsh warning for North Korea.
That is absolutely correct. He did arrive earlier than most of the other leaders. He did come to Seoul on Sunday, and he immediately went off to the border, the demilitarized zone on the border between South and North Korea, where he spoke before the troops, praised them, and then went off to basically lay it on heavy onto North Korea, saying that their behavior cannot be tolerated, that they're provoking, that they're challenging the world, and said that by carrying out missile tests, they're only further isolating itself. Now, the missile tests which we're talking about are, in fact, what North Korea says is a satellite launch, which is due to happen next month. But the United States and South Korea and Japan now saying the same thing, view it as Pyongyang's test of its weaponry, and they're stringently, extremely against it. Now, of course, the United States, President Obama in particular, has seems to have used the sidelines of the nuclear security summit in order to discuss a lot of international issues, but primarily it looks like the U.S. is looking to increase its presence in Asia, particularly in the Pacific, in the Asia-Pacific region. And the U.S. president has never made a secret of it. He always said that was exactly the intent of the United States. There is talk about stationing U.S. ships on a naval base, which is being built by South Korea right now. There is also, you have to remember that more than 28,000 U.S. Military personnel are already stationed here in South Korea. There is also a military base being built in Australia, which is to house more than 2,500 U.S. troops. And basically, a lot of people view this as yet another chance for the current U.S. president to increase U.S. presence in the region, somehow showing China that, in fact, the United States is still present here and is strong, and that Chinese presence, which is also increasing over the past several years, is something that the United States is watching and keeping close tabs on.
RT's Irina Galushka reporting from Seoul. Thank you. The U.S. president has tried to win support from China to increase pressure on North Korea. Dr. Tim Beal, author and Asia specialist, says there's nothing legally wrong in Pyongyang's actions.
The Koreans quite correctly.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the last half hour of the Heretics Hour tonight. And I'm Carolyn Yeager, and my guest is Don, who is a lawyer. And he's been telling us about the sad situation of whites in America, and that whites are an inferior class now, and legally, it seems, you know, as policy, at least, as, you know, as public policy, we are on the bottom of the heap now in who gets attention. So the call-in number, I invite you to call in if you have a question or if you want to engage with Don on any of the things he's been saying. The number is 1-855-477-2283. So, Don, you're telling me something during the break. I'd like you to repeat it if you can remember what it was.
Yeah, I said the ironic thing is that in the 19th century, when they had a slavery, they had a racial caste system that they at least called it slavery. Today they're trying to reverse the roles, only they don't call it slavery or even servitude. They call it equality and civil rights and anti-discrimination. And that's kind of the really weird thing about it is you inflict the same kind of thing, but you call it a different name so that nobody recognizes it, notwithstanding that they are the direct victims of it.
Well, that's it. You cannot. It's going to be very. It's very hard to convince white people in the United States today that they are second class citizens, or that they don't have rights, and that minorities, what used to be called minorities, have more rights than they do. They don't feel that way. It doesn't look that way to them, and that is because I think because we are a more intelligent and capable people, so we can make, you know, we can do better for ourselves than these so-called minorities. But they get all this government help. We think, well, they need it and they should have it. It's just very hard to show for people to see the big picture of what's really happening. Although you were saying that you think that it's so becoming so obvious that they can't help but see it.
I don't talk to anybody who doesn't see it. Everybody I know sees it. I mean, if you read the jurisprudence and the cases, well, you know, sure, whites are going to be subjected. They're going to be indentured to minorities. You've got 300 years of slavery and Jim Crow and lynching and blah, blah, blah. And, I mean, white people know it, and they're willing to accept it because of something called white guilt. You're going to have to challenge white guilt. You're going to have to say, if blacks are responsible, we shouldn't be held responsible for things that were done by people who died before we were born. Okay, I'm sorry for slavery. I'm sorry they were brought here. It was the worst tragedy of this country. But, you know, I can't undo, you know, 300 years of history that occurred before I was born. I have little enough control over what goes on now. You know, that
I'm only sorry that there were slaves were brought here because they're still here. You know, I have a hard time thinking that it was as terrible as they want to make out, because these people sure didn't have anything good in Africa, and they were enslaved by their own fellow Africans. And terrible thing, all this was going on, and when they were brought here, at least in a couple generations, they became African Americans, and now they wouldn't go back to Africa. If you paid them probably $100,000 each, they wouldn't go back. So terrible happened to these people.
Well, I think some of the things are pretty terrible, but the interesting is if you look at the demographics of the slavery, the slave populations steadily increased throughout the colonial period and certainly throughout the period since the end of the Civil War, whereas white birth rates are declining and we're headed toward extinction. I don't know that anyone ever called for the extinction of black people. I've never heard that one, although some of the Civil War generals, like Sherman, called for the extermination of white Southerners. But
yes,
you know, separate and apart from that issue, also the blacks were brought here involuntarily. But like you say, none of them ever show much interest in leaving. And then the Mexicans come here voluntarily for the better life that they could never create in their own land. And then they get listed as historically oppressed minorities.
And yeah, then they complain about everything.
If we brought them here, we're guilty for that. 300 years ago, we're guilty for that. If they come here voluntarily, we're guilty for that. It's kind of interesting. I was going through the California Corporations Code a couple of years ago, and I found they have this thing where they have an official classification of historically oppressed minorities, and they have a list with the California Department of Corporations or the Secretary of State's office, where if you need a historically oppressed minority to serve on the board of your corporation in order to fill some quota, they actually have a registry of these people. And then I saw some other stuff where the Code of Federal Regulations has an official classification of people as historically oppressed minorities. Well, what does that mean? It means everybody except white people. Well, if everybody except white people is oppressed, who are the oppressors? How smart do you have to be to figure that one out? We are already officially classified as oppressors in federal law and in state law. That is how odious and how evil and how explicit this has become.
That's not nice. That's not nice at all. We have a caller, Don. So I believe it's Hadding from Florida.
Yes.
Hi, Hadding.
Yes.
What do you have to say?
Well, Carolyn, first, I want to point out to you, you are talking to a lawyer there. So the arguments that he's going to use are going to be based on what looks like it has some validity within the status quo and the principles that it espouses or pretends to espouse. So, you know, he comes up with equal rights for whites because within this system, that looks like an argument that theoretically should work.
Yes. Yes, I finally admitted that to him. That he's got a good case there, better than, even though I don't like it, but I'm on a totally different wavelength, but, you know, and he's more connected to what's to the people and what's possible.
It doesn't
well, Hattie,
mean
can
that
I ask you a question?
Yeah.
What's your argument?
What's my argument?
Yeah.
White survival.
Well, that's mine too. But I mean, how are you going to come up with an argument that you can make that people feel comfortable in making? You know,
well,
white supremacy, bring back slavery, bring back segregation.
No, what you do, look, no, the fundamental thing is you got to show white people that they are under attack as a race because they are white. This is something that has to be shown all the time, and it's reality. You show them that they're under attack. Then they'll start to think collectively and start to think about circling the wagons. As long as they don't feel threatened, they're not going to do that.
Yeah, that's why I said that I don't think most people feel threatened. But, you know, you live in a urban area where you say there's hardly any white people, so the white people are realizing. But, you know, so much damage is already done, whereas you go into a lot of more rural or Midwestern areas and people don't understand. When you talk to them like that, they should. They really should. They see enough, but they don't. They don't want to, because of their, what they've been taught how to think about people.
White guilt.
Yeah, white guilt. I don't know if it's guilt. They just have this think they have to feel sorry for people who they see as less well off than they are. But the fact of it is that these people don't have less opportunities, they just have less capability. And that's why they look so pathetic to the white people. If you know what I'm saying there.
Yeah, I think the perception of that is changing.
I hope so. But,
there's
you know,
also, yeah.
But what
there's
about the Jew? Okay, go ahead.
I was going to say there's also a kind of self-gratification that comes from the feeling of superiority, you know, they get
maybe
certain pleasure out of condescending to these brown and black people and helping them, you know. Somehow helping other white people doesn't give the same thrill.
Well, you're right about that.
I think a lot of the brown and black people are not, certainly some of them are, but a lot of them are not consciously thinking that they want to replace or the whites or take over because they want to live in white society. But what they don't understand is that, and here I go again, but that there's a huge Jewish power in this country, and they are the ones who are behind this this change in American society so that the whites don't have any power. I think they're the ones who are behind it.
That's true, but the lack of wariness on the part of our own people is a more fundamental problem, and also the greed and backstabbing of our own people. All of that trend started before the Jews came in, who were old hands at it, and just really took advantage of the situation.
Well, how do we distinguish between the greedy, backstabbing whites and the whites that are worth saving, or that aren't doing that? I mean, this gets to be a real problem then.
I think they'll sort themselves out. But Don, you know, I really wasn't attacking your legalistic argument there. I mean, I think if we're not going to imagine that we're going to overthrow the government anytime soon, then we have to be able to engage the system, and that means speak to it on its own terms and whatever terms look as if they should work. As long as we don't fall into the trap of also, which I think a lot of Republicans also fall into, of thinking that the way we have to talk to the system is the way reality is, then I think it's okay.
Well, I know I'm never going to win an argument with the people that want to destroy us. I'm formulating arguments to persuade white people to give them something they can stand up with and argue and feel good about it and feel moral about it. I mean, if you can't argue equality, what can you argue?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have to give our people something they can say. You have to give them something they can feel comfortable with. And I work with some young kids and who go to school and they get this crap pounded into them. And, boy, the equal rights for whites. I some of them come back and told me, boy, we use that in school, and they don't know what to say. You know, they stammer and stumble, and so it's kind of an informal little lab, and it's not a scientific method or polling or anything like that, but it's worked for me in my dealings with other people. It is firmly based on the law and the Constitution, at least facially based on the law and the Constitution. I think equal rights for whites is a weapon we can give our people they feel comfortable in using. Now, if you could find millions of whites who would feel comfortable with ship them all back to where they came from, I'll jump on board that one too.
I have a question.
I mean,
you
got it. You got to take one step before you complete the journey.
Yeah.
Well, equal rights for whites, then we have to specify what rights we're exactly talking about and why we don't.
The right of freedom of association, the right of freedom of contract. The right to sell your house to who you want to sell it to. You know, I was listening, very interesting, I was listening to a tape of George Lincoln Rockwell, one of his speeches in the 60s, and he pointed out the same year that Barry Goldwater crashed and burned in California in 64, Proposition 14, which affirmed the rights of people to sell their houses to whomever they wanted to, that passed by an overwhelming majority. Now figure that one out.
Mm-hmm. I think everybody feels that is the right. That's a sensible right. People should be able to dispose of their property the way they want to, and they don't believe that the government has a right to come in and tell them. But the government has pushed that through, and once it's the law, there's not much they can do about it. That's the problem we have.
Well, the problem is it's only enforced against us. It's not enforced against all these other people because, most white people don't want to move to a black neighborhood.
Yeah.
They don't want to move
yeah.
to a Hispanic neighborhood because they're not suitable for human habitation. Okay, that's the problem. White neighborhoods are suitable for human habitation, and that's why everybody wants to move into
them. Well, when we get into that argument.
In a nice place until they destroy it.
Yeah, when we get into that argument, then it takes it away from just equal rights and goes into what you might call racial animosity or something.
It doesn't get away from equal rights. Look, we have a big deal going on now. There's a big political war in Los Angeles County between the blacks and the Hispanics. Okay, they're trying to redraw the council districts, and they want to have it drawn so that all the blacks are in one district so they can have black representation. Okay, we got black congressional districts drawn so that Maxine Waters can be elected and put into Congress. Blacks
right.
rely on racial segregation. With no racial segregation, you don't have a concentration of black votes that elects Maxine Waters. If you have complete integration, there's no black elected office holders. So they rely on racial segregation. They rely on all the things they deny us to maintain their political power and rub our noses in it.
Yeah, but that, but the law would say, if you're a white person and you want to move into a black neighborhood and there's a house for sale, they cannot deny you the right to buy that house. But see, the fact is just that we don't want
to. Oh, yeah? I know white construction workers that have been driven out of Los Angeles County because they can't get any work. People won't hire anything but Mexicans. Even the blacks are being ethnic.
Okay, well, in employment, you could probably find that. But not in buying a house, I don't think.
Nobody wants to buy a house in a black neighborhood except Mexicans, and they're basically buying up all the houses and kicking them. They're kicking the blacks out. There are areas in Los Angeles, and this is very, very well known, where blacks can't even go without fear of being shot on sight by Mexicans. This whole thing about, you know, Mexicans mm-hmm. shoot blacks every day here in L.A.
Yes,
nobody
yeah.
much cares about it because they can't draw attention to it and stir up hatred against white people if they talk about what illegal alien Mexicans are doing. See, that's not useful. That doesn't help them attack white people. They're only interested in things that attack and destroy white people. And that's part of this. And
hey, Don, there.
I'm quite people. Hello?
Yeah, we'll continue. I'll wait.
You know, that's just my point. I think white people do feel under siege. I mean, you got white flight. Mm-hmm. Whites can't run anywhere else. There's nowhere else left to run. They're going to have to fight this time.
Okay. Hattie?
All right. Yes, I wanted to run a couple of things past you here. You talk about the fact that people can't choose to whom they'll sell their home. I heard
right.
Kievsky talk about something recently. Basically, his idea is if you don't offer a home for sale publicly, then you can choose the buyer.
So
if you have your friends, your circle of friends, and you put the word out among your circle of friends that you have a piece of property for sale, and you wait until somebody in your circle of friends wants to buy it, then you're immune from all this fair housing stuff.
Yeah, but see, a lot of people, most people aren't going to do that because they want, if they want to sell their house, they want to sell their house. So they're not going to wait years for some white person. Yeah.
That's like almost having to go underground.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do we have to do, you know?
Well, I guess, I mean, I didn't come on to so much talk about how to beat the system the way it is as to how to, you know, summon people to challenge the system the way it is and to, you know, motivate white people to fight back.
Well, what would be the first step? I think, of course, the first step, people listening to this and getting mad and feeling all this and getting the right idea. But is there, I'm always looking for some practical step for people to take or what would be recommended. What would you say is the most important thing, Don, that the average white person should start out with?
Well, the average white person who is aware needs to support white voices like you and others that are on the radio. Frankly, that's one thing you have to do. But I mean, it's hard to say. We need leaders, and our people
yes,
aren't being led.
Yes,
and leaderless
yes.
people are like ships without rudders.
Yes.
And, you know, I talk to my circle of people, and I've come up with some really, really hard arguments. See, the thing that people are most afraid of is being called a racist. It's like we're gullivers, and we're being held down by our own fear of these yapping minority parasites. They're going to call us a racist. That's outliving its usefulness. People more and more have had enough of this crap. I mean, I can remember the 50s and the 60s. That's half a century of this crap. When is mm-hmm. it ever going to end? It's not going to end. This isn't like the 60s. People have had it. They've had it.
Well, I hope so. We better have had it, or we've had it.
And that's why I think, you have to have a narrative they can use, and you have to have people that are leaders.
We need leaders. Let me say something about leaders. We really need leaders, and I think the reason that the people who the only people we can think of who are leaders are not real leaders is because they won't go far out enough or they won't go extreme enough. They're too careful, and if you're too careful, you're not saying anything to people and you're not going to do anything.
True.
And also they don't want to be leaders because that's too much responsibility. They've got other, you know, they're writers, they're teachers, or this and that. So we really need very tough talking leaders, which is why I try to talk tough, but I am not a leader, and I'm not going to be the leader. I'm just not that. I'm not made of that. So I'm too old. but I know how much we need leaders, and I'm really unhappy that we have too many people who are kind of holding things down. I think people who are in a kind of a leadership position, but who are holding down so that we don't get too extreme. And they don't want to be extremists. They don't want to be called a racist. They don't want to have the ADL come down on them. And I think we have to go beyond all that and forget about all that and become a much more strong spoken. Is that you saying that's right, Henning? Okay.
I think in numbers there is strength, and I think you're going to have more and more white people who are going to be receptive to this stuff. I see a lot of kids. I'll tell you, I was led into the white. Well, I became racially conscious because of young high school kids who were into this stuff. And I thought they were really extremists. I said, you can't say that. That's racist. They said, look, we have to put up with this crap in school. We get hammered with this stuff. We have to take this crap. What do you know? And I said, maybe the Bible was right. A child shall lead them. I'll tell you, a child led me. White children led me to the positions I take now. And people are stunned to hear that. But a lot of these young white kids that have to put up with this crap day in and day out about white guilt and slavery and Jim Crow and the Indians and we stole America, they've had enough of this. They've had enough of it.
Well, I hope so.
I work with them.
Okay, Hattie?
Yeah, the whole premise of Fox News and a lot of Republican right-wing talk radio is that the audience is a bunch of white people that are angry. I mean, you think about it, that's really the premise of it, mm-hmm. that they use it constantly. They use the immigration issue to keep those people listening. I heard Bob Grant from his broadcast last Sunday. He said people already know that white people are under attack. They just need to get some courage. I mean, this is Bob Grant. He's on WABC, New York City.
Well said. Mm-hmm. Well said.
Maybe if more and more people are saying this and they hear it more and more, it might, take hold. Because
people don't know what to do.
My assessment is I read the comment sections on some of these news stories, on the Internet news stories. In the last 5 years, I have seen a huge, huge change. I mean, you look at most of these comments on these stories, like the Trayvon Martin thing, it's like they come off, David Duke's website or Stormfront or something. I mean, you look at the Internet, and there was a discussion on this on talk radio out here a few weeks ago. They said, this is a problem because with the anonymity of the Internet, people can say anything they really feel, and all this white stuff is coming out. And they had the hour of anonymity where people could come in and say anything they wanted to say. And it's like there's this boiling pot there of white anger and white rage. And, I hope the blacks burn a city or two down over this Trayvon Martin thing. I think that's all it's going to take to really make whites get furious. You see it on the Internet, this flash mob crap and black killing, black crime. They're not able to, I remember the 60s, and they could sit on this stuff, and they could beat it into us how guilty we all were, and, that isn't going to work this time. It's not working this time. That's my perception of it. And that's not very scientific, and it's not,
Well, I sure feel different than I did back then, but then I've come a long way, but I think that's probably true. However, they still have an awful lot of power. They have a way to do real false flags and to create things which totally take everybody's attention away and put them back under the listening to the to the fake leader all the time. And this is what worries me, because I think whites would stand up and do something, but they have lots of plans in store for what to do if whites do that. And we have to be aware of that too.
Look, I was very heartened by the Tea Party movement because it was like 95% white.
Mm-hmm.
you know, and all of those people who went to Washington, D.C., paid their own way. It wasn't like when the blacks went there in the Martin Luther King thing in 63 where they were bussed in by labor unions. I was astonished when Glenn Beck had his rally.
Okay.
I watched.
I don't want to interrupt you, Don, but we have just about half a minute, so finish up. And I want to thank you, too, for being on.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. I enjoyed it too, and I hope you'll come back again. I'd like to have you on again. We got 30 seconds, so if you have any last minute words, and I want to thank Hadding too, in case we get blared out with the music. But any last minute words, Don? Go ahead.
Yeah, 15
seconds.
equal rights for whites. Don't forget it. Put it on a banner and go out and have a demonstration with it.
Okay.
Don't let your voice be smothered.
Okay, well, you can start with that, folks. Equal rights for whites. So thank you, Don. Thank you, Hadding. It was a good program. And we'll be back next week, ladies and gentlemen, with our German friend.
All righty.
Good night.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.